people will use buzzwords as vague answers that can convince their mock interview partners that they are a solution to the problem. And the mock interview partner might even say, yeah, that solves the problem. Like, if you do marketing, you can sell more. And the interviewer is not going to buy that. And if the person can use that during their preparation, they're never even going to learn how to think proper way about how to sell more, for example. Welcome to the Case Interview Podcast. If you're tired of BS, generic case interview advice, then you've come to the right place. Here, we'll share practical insights, systems, and techniques that we've battle-tested with real candidates to help them get their offers at top consulting firms like McKinsey, BCG, and Bain. If you want to know more about our work, visit craftingcases.com and get instant access to our exclusive case prep material. Now, let's go on to today's episode.
Julio, I have a question to ask you.
Yeah.
Would you say that this podcast creates a sustainable competitive advantage to reinforce the positioning and brand awareness to our Crafting Cases brand, thus creating a disruption in the case interview preparation marketplace?
Huh? I have no idea what you just said.
Julio, today's episode is about buzzwords. We're going to talk about five buzzwords candidates should avoid using in their case interviews. It's a phenomenon that I think is interesting because why do people use buzzwords in the first place? And I have a pet theory for that.
Yeah, what is it?
You know, I think especially when you're a college student, or maybe you're an MBA, but you didn't do business stuff before joining your MBA. And whenever you're trying to break into a new industry where you know less about that industry than the people who are in the industry, so whenever you're trying to fit in some place that's new to you, you want to sound smart and sound like you belong. And one of the tools that people use to do that is, of course, language. And the problem is that there are those little mistakes that people use when they're using new language. And I think buzzwords are one of those. So they basically use buzzwords to sound smart.
Yeah.
I see that a lot with people who are studying to become doctors. I mean, my parents are doctors, yours as well. You know what I'm talking about. When there's that young person in the family and they're trying to become a doctor, they're studying for it, and they start using these medicine words all the time, like way more than real doctors use them. And it's kind of the same thing. They're trying to sound smart, sound like they belong.
Yeah.
But all it says to the people who actually do the craft of consulting or of medicine is that they're new here. And it's all fine. I mean, people have been through it. But the problem is when you use buzzwords wrong or out of context. Would you agree with me?
Yeah, definitely. When you use buzzwords to fit in the group, if you're trying to fit, then you're not fit yet, right? You're not completely fit. So you're probably going to use them a little bit off their correct place or off their correct meaning, right?
Yeah.
And it's probably a lot worse to do that when you're actually being evaluated. Like if you're a kid, new kid on the block, trying to fit in with the new kids, every time you say a buzzword that they use and you use it a little bit wrong, you're going to be bullied. And of course, yeah, the interviewer is not going to bully you in the case interview. They might just write down, oh, this person doesn't, they use words that they don't know what they mean exactly, which is kind of a problem for a consultant to do with a client. But they also, they might challenge you and ask you, you know, tell me more. What does that mean? Why are you saying this?
And then most people just dig themselves into a hole.
Yeah.
What I would say that's troublesome as well is that when you're, for example, a medical student, you're actually studying those terms and usually names of diseases and, you know, treatments and stuff like that. You're studying that in depth, right? So you tend not to use the words with the wrong meaning. You kind of use them out of place and out of context, but you tend to use the right meaning to the words. And also medical terms tend to be very precise because it's basically science, right?
Mm-hmm.
With business and consulting, I think two different things happen. The first one is that a lot of people haven't studied for a decade like medical students do. Some people are just like, they didn't have a business background or they had a little bit of a business background, but they use these buzzwords anyway. And what ends up happening is that not only they overuse these words and they use them out of context, but they also get the wrong meaning.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is business jargon doesn't always have a precise meaning. So different authors have their definitions, and also people are like creating new jargons and new words all the time just so they can kind of like publish a book on that new term and be the owner of that term so they can sell more books and then eventually sell workshops and lectures and consulting. One example that comes to mind is you used to have the term KPI, which is key performance indicator,
mm-hmm.
or key performance indicators, which is basically all the important things that you measure to check a company's health
mm-hmm.
and how well they're doing. And then this guy came up with OKR, which is the new thing right now, which means one key result, I think.
Yeah.
Which is basically the idea that you should choose one KPI for each person because you shouldn't have more than one in this guy's idea. But the point is OKR, KPI, it's all the same thing. But if you want to sell more speeches and workshops and stuff like that, you have to come up with your own term. So business have a lot of those. And people who aren't used to this field for a long time, they think that these things are more scientific than they actually are.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, you actually have things that have very precise definitions, like price sensitivity or barriers to entry. And they have very precise definitions, but a lot of people use them in the wrong way. So if you just overhear these things, you're going to learn them slightly wrong or slightly out of context. And you're going to use these buzzwords and jargon in a way that basically shows that you know nothing that you're talking about,
mm-hmm.
or that you know less than you actually think you know, which is a problem in cases and in consulting with clients as well.
Yeah. And there's yet another problem that buzzwords bring to candidates when they're doing case interviews. And that is many times they work as a clutch so that the candidate doesn't have to think about a real answer to a problem. One example that I'm going to give you, and I'm going to go deeper into this one when we actually start going into buzzwords, but one example is marketing. And sometimes
that was my first buzzword. So should we jump into the buzzwords themselves?
It was my first as well. Yeah, let's jump into the buzzwords. But let me just clarify this problem first. People will use buzzwords as vague answers that can convince their mock interview partners that they are a solution to the problem. And the mock interview partner might even say, yeah, that solves the problem. Like if you do marketing, you can sell more. And the interviewer mm-hmm. is not going to buy that. And mm-hmm. if the person can use that during their preparation, they're never even going to learn how to think proper way about how to sell more, for example. And so they're going to be caught off hand because since they were using buzzwords and that felt good, that felt like they were answering the question, but they were actually just being vague, they never learn how to think the proper way.
So just so the people listening to this can picture this, what you're saying, as I understand, is that if you use buzzwords a lot, or you think buzzwords are good, or you don't know the definition of a specific buzzword, and you do a lot of mock interviews with other people who also don't know how to use buzzwords well or use too many buzzwords, which is most of the candidates,
mm-hmm.
then you're just reinforcing this wrong usage. And then when you go to an interview and your interviewer calls you out, you don't know how to react because you're basically saying that mock interviews are not a good representation of reality when it comes to buzzwords.
Perfect.
Is that right?
Yeah.
All right. So let's jump into the buzzwords that candidates should avoid. The five of them we have for today. The first one, as you said, is marketing. Why is it such a big deal to say For example, just to give you a common usage,
mm-hmm.
like sales are down and you found out that that's because we're losing customers. So you did the profit tree. You're trying to understand why profits are down. You did the profit tree. You broke down into revenue minus costs. You found out that the problem is that customers are leaving for the competitors. And the interviewer asks you, what can we do about that? And one of the, you create a brainstorming tree. Let's say your technique is perfect. You create a brainstorming MIC tree. And one of your ideas is to do more marketing. Is that kind of the usage that people do?
That is precisely the usage that I was thinking about. Marketing is also my first buzzword in my list. And I had someone email me and ask me about this the other day. And they were saying, oh, I have this tree to improve sales here. And one of the main issues that she had written in her structure was marketing. This is how I'm going to improve sales.
Yeah.
It's such a problem because what does it even mean? I assume she meant advertising, which
yeah.
by itself, it could work, but it's not going to increase sales by itself. You should say,
yeah.
I am going to do advertising so that people who currently don't know my business will get to know my business, or so that people who don't remember my business are going to remember about my business when they are shopping or whatever. But it's she's just not saying anything when she says, I'm going to do more marketing. That's not a thing.
It's such a cop-out answer because every business could do more marketing or better marketing. Like, it's one of the main things, right? If you do marketing well, wisdom says that you're pretty much set up with your business. But the problem is that, as you said, marketing is advertising, it's pricing, it's customer segmentation, it's positioning, it's branding, it's distribution channels, it's even product development could mm-hmm. be called marketing, right? It's
yeah.
packaging. Like, there's tons of things that are marketing. So you basically can't be wrong by saying that, yeah, they can increase sales by doing more or better marketing. The problem is if you can't be wrong, you can't be right either. It just means your answer is not specific enough. To your point with the advertising thing, I agree. Advertising could work better, but in my opinion, it's not specific enough yet.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you've diagnosed the problem properly, it should be more specific than that. It should be,
yeah.
well, we should do online advertising because that's where our competitors are getting most of their customers and we don't do that yet. Or we should advertise to this specific customer segment about the existence and the benefits of our product because they don't know that our product exists yet. Or we should do advertising to this specific customer segment that knows our product, but they use it in a wrong way. And because of that, they switch to the competitor. So something way more specific. Like, you shouldn't talk about the tool, which is advertising, but you should talk about what problem will the tool fix and how. That's the level of specificity that you need.
Perfect. Let's go to the next buzzword then.
All right. So the next buzzword is research or customer research, but it could be any kind of research. So just to paint the picture to our listeners, let's say you are trying to solve a case where you're trying to figure out whether there will be demand for a new product or not. Let's say it's a product launch case. It could also be a government case, for example. A government wants to launch a new initiative to help senior citizens get more joy and purpose in their life. So regardless of what new initiative, you want to figure out whether there's demand for it or not, right?
Mm-hmm.
For a new product, a new service, private or public sector. Then how will you figure out if there's demand? A lot of candidates will say, oh, we should do some research.
Yes, exactly.
Is that a common usage for you? Do you see any other situations where people might suggest that?
People tend to suggest research to finding out the why for any kind of behavior. So if customers stop buying, people tend to jump straight away to research. Or if, let's say, customers prefer competitors or whatever, they tend to jump straight away to research. When yes, research could be an answer, but there are several other hypotheses that you can test in easier ways than research. And sometimes they will say research and not know what the hell they're talking about. Like, why? Why are you going to do research? What are you going to ask? To whom? Right?
Yeah, I was gonna say, like, it used to happen a lot when we would coach candidates that, like, especially beginner candidates, that they would suggest research. And my initial reaction as a coach, pretty much my only reaction as a coach, would be to probe very deeply into that. Because I wanted to see if they knew what they're talking about. Because sometimes research was the right answer.
Yeah.
Or one good answer. But how can you know if the only thing they say is we should do customer research? Like, they could just be bullshitting me. Like, research, like marketing, it's like, it can never be wrong, right? Who would tell you, yeah, don't do customer research. It's a terrible thing to do. So what I would say to them is, okay, why research? What are your other options besides research? Why is research the best option? Who would you ask? What would you ask them? And how would you ask them? So I'm basically saying, stop giving the answer that could never be wrong and start. Let's get into the tactics here.
Yeah.
And to clarify to people, sometimes it is the right answer. And I think you have a story about your Bain interviews where you gave you told the interviewer that you would do research to figure something out, right?
Yeah,
it turned out to be
a good answer. It was my second ever interview, so it was a little bit scary. What happened was, it was a profitability case, and as it turns out, shoe sales were down for a shoe retail company.
So it was a shoe store, like a company that owned several shoe
stores. Yeah, exactly. Okay. They sold multi-brand. Actually, they sold own-brand shoes. And as it turns out, customers were going into the stores as always. So the volume of customers coming in the stores was the same, but they were buying a lot less. And I didn't have that much background in case interviews. But what came to me was, there's hardly anything we can do except for ask these people why they're not buying the shoes. Are they buying something else? Mm-hmm. Do they not like the shoes, or do they like something else? Is it expensive? Like, what's going on?
Mm-hmm.
And I told my interviewer, so we should do research and ask them. And she right away turned back to me and said, oh, so you're going to spend $200,000 on a research with X company just to ask those people why they're not buying the shoes.
She put you in the spot.
She put me in the spot, and in a scary way. She was a little bit aggressive, and
yeah,
which was probably a good thing of her to do. And she was probably freaking tired of listening to candidates say research and not giving any details, because this is not the good way to answer. Like, you shouldn't just say research, right? But
it's kind of like saying advertising.
Exactly.
Like, okay, it works in business, but what kind of advertising, to whom? What are the things we're going to communicate, right?
Yeah, and if a candidate says advertising and it's right, the interviewer can't say bingo and hire you. Because since you didn't give the why, they can't tell if they can trust you for other problems. They can't tell if they can trust you to, you know, drop you in the client side and you solve their problem. So they need to know the why. That's probably why she was a little bit annoyed. I would be too.
Yeah.
And so she said, oh, what the hell? Tell me more. Why are you going to do research or whatever?
I love how she put a ticket on your recommendation, because it makes like some casual recommendation. Oh, we should do research now. It puts you in the project situation, like, oh, shit. Actually, like, if I were in a project and I suggested that, it would actually cost me like $200,000 to do that. Like, am I actually sure that this is the only and or best path to pursue now? Mm-hmm. So I love how vivid it is.
Yeah.
What'd you do next?
So I thought for a few seconds. I questioned myself for a little bit. But I searched my mind, and it seemed like the only thing to be done. And I said, yeah, we need to ask them this, this, and that. Because otherwise, we really can't find another way to tell what the reason is for them to stop buying. And then she immediately said, yes, that's right. That's exactly what we did in the real project. And these are our findings. And gave me an exhibit.
That's cool. So I like how you defended your ideas. I want to give people the other side of the coin for this. So when does this go wrong?
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, there's the case where you can't, you don't know, like, what would you ask and to whom? And then it's basically like, you're obviously repeating something from the case book.
Mm-hmm.
And you're saying, yeah, we should use a hammer because, you know, I'm the guy with a hammer and everything is a nail.
Yeah.
But there's the other situation where people will say they will do research and it's actually the wrong tool.
Yeah, let me just give an example of this really quick from my own interview. If I had said that we should do research before knowing that there were less people coming into the store, even though that's the right answer, I would have been wrong. Because it would be super easy to know if there were less people coming into the store. And that could be the reason why people were buying less shoes.
And that's something you can measure quickly.
Exactly.
Yeah, I agree with you. Although then you could ask, well, why are they not coming into the store? And then the answer could be customer research as well. I agree.
Yeah.
But there are times where research is not the right answer. And I have two common situations where this is true. The first one is when you can't trust your customers' words. And this is more common than people think. So if you give them a product, for example, and say, hey, do you like this product? Usually people want to be agreeable and be nice to people. And they don't really know if they would use it or not. People don't know about their own behavior in the future. It's hard for you to know. Like, if I give you a new microphone, for example, to record this podcast, you might be, oh, this is a cool microphone. And then maybe you will use it and maybe not. But you'd probably say something that's nice to the person asking this. And you'd say, yeah, of course I would. That it looks like a nice microphone. So when you can't trust people, it's usually better to see what their behavior is.
Mm-hmm.
So one way to test hypotheses about the customer, about behavior, without doing research is actually observing their behavior. And another way to test hypotheses, and it could be to look at people's behavior or to do something else, is to do pilot programs or quick actual tests. For example, will this new store format work?
Yeah.
You could do research about whether people like this new store format, if they would shop in it, or you can just open a store. And sometimes opening the store is cheaper than doing the research, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you open a store in a prime location, in a place where people are likely to like this new format, and you see what happens, and you measure stuff. Or you can check past behavior, which was my prior example, and see like other industries or other geographies where stores in this new format were opened, you can see what the behavior of the people was.
Mm-hmm.
So these are two ways. Oftentimes they overlap. But just to give people some examples when research would not be the best tool. Sometimes it's too expensive. Sometimes you can't trust the answers. And there's always that research firm that has, you know, new statistical analysis that prove something that you kind of feel like you can't trust people. But sometimes they're just trying to sell their services. So you can't really trust that most of the times either. So that's research. And I think there's a common theme here.
Mm-hmm.
There's the advertising, the research. Be wary, guys and girls, with the tools. When you suggest tools, but you don't suggest why you should use this tool and not others, how to use this tool effectively, when to use this tool, with whom should you use this tool, then it's probably a bullshit answer with a buzzword attached to it.
And it is possible that it has truth to the answer. You just have to be more specific.
Yeah. Another pattern that I notice is that a lot of people who suggest research are people in advertising as well. They're people who come from marketing backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing against people with marketing backgrounds, but as any background, they have their biases. And they're used to solve problems in a certain way and using certain tools. But as management consultants, they have to be open to all the tools from all the fields. And of course, people with engineering and sciences backgrounds, they have their own biases as well. They try to use too much statistical analysis and stuff like that, and they forget to ask the customer stuff. So there are biases on both sides. but just calling this out because your own background can interfere on the buzzwords you tend to get attached to. Shall we move on to the third buzzword people should avoid?
Yes. What is it?
So, customer preferences.
Oh, customer preferences. The famous buzzwords of people who have studied too many frameworks.
Yeah.
If you have studied too many frameworks, you will have read in every single market entry case that you need to know customer preferences so that you can decide whether you're going into that market being better than other companies at something. But the frameworks never tell you the details, and they never tell you exactly how to present that. They're going to say customer preferences, and people who study too much those frameworks and trust them too much will get to their interview and say, I need to know customer preferences. And they can't tell exactly the why. They can't tell exactly what. And if you just say that, you are bullshitting because it would fit nearly every single case. If it would fit every single case, the interviewer knows that it would fit all cases they have in their minds and that you're not necessarily thinking.
Yeah, there's a concept that we've created to help people create better structures and frameworks, which is the toothbrush test. And we'll probably do an episode on that. But there's a YouTube video and an article if people want to Google it. It's called the toothbrush test. And the core idea of the toothbrush test is that if you're solving a case and you give an idea or a hypothesis that is so generic that you could use the same idea in a case in the toothbrush industry, and I just picked a random industry to create this concept, then it's probably not specific enough. You're probably just reading something off a casebook or gathering from memory something that you read off a casebook. So let's say you're doing a case on airlines and you say, I want to understand the customer preferences. And your interviewer is like, well, what about them? Because you could have used customer preferences in a case in the toothbrush industry, in the M&A law industry,
mm-hmm.
in the gardening industry, right? You can use that in any industry. So your interviewer will ask, what about the customer preferences? And then some candidates, not the good ones, but some candidates get stuck and they're like, well, it's important to know about the customer to make decisions. So we should understand what their preferences are. Now, how would a good candidate react? They'd probably say something like, well, I need to know the customer preferences, specifically the segments of customers that we're attacking or the routes that we care the most, what is most important to them. For example, if we're trying to get customers who are traveling for business in major routes, they probably care a lot about how on time our flights are. They probably care a lot about luggage. So if they can carry luggage in the cabin, because they're business travelers, they don't want to take a lot of time gathering their luggage after the flight. And they probably care a lot about online check-ins and ease of changing their tickets. So you're much more specific. The interviewer will say, okay, I can actually put this guy in front of an executive in the airline industry and he would know this stuff up front and he can ask the client. But if the client challenges them, they can say something that's smart, right? It's not like, well, you tell me about your customer preferences because, you know, I'm here to gather information. Clients have that saying that consultants steal your watch to tell you what time it is. And I think it's a good analogy. I mean, it's a common saying, and I think it's there because it's truth to some extent. I think it's a good analogy for bad consultants. One that I used to hear a lot at McKinsey is that customers borrow, they don't steal, they borrow the watches from a lot of people in the organization, and each watch tells a different time. And this is kind of referring to the fact that different people in the organization have different opinions. And consultants are the people who say, well, your watch is telling you that it's, you know, 6:30 p.m. Your watch is telling you it's 8:15. The actual time mm-hmm. is this. And thus, we should do that.
Yeah.
So just got off on a tangent here, but that's the problem with customer preferences in my perspective.
Yeah, that's how I see it as well.
Yeah, moving on to buzzword you should avoid, number 4. Porter's Five Forces. Or any of the buzzwords that are within Porter's Five Forces. So barriers to entry, risk of substitution, bargaining power of customers. Now, Julio, what is the problem with these words? And especially saying, I'm going to run a five forces analysis here.
It's essentially the same as saying, let's say you get a profitability case and you say, I'm going to run a profitability analysis and find out what the problem is.
Mm-hmm.
Then you're telling them, I don't know how to do this.
Yeah.
I don't know what I'm talking about. I can't run this analysis.
Yeah. I heard a saying once that, what was the saying again? It was something like, AI is kind of like teenage sex. Everyone says they do it. Everyone thinks everyone's doing it, but no one's doing it. Yeah, I don't know if this podcast not PG-13 anymore. But anyway, I think Porter's Five Forces is kind of like that, you know? People mm-hmm. say they understand Porter's Five Forces. People can name the things that go, like a lot of people, a lot of MBA students or people who've done a couple business classes in university, or even people who don't have a business background but have read a couple case books, they can name what the five forces are.
Mm-hmm.
Much less common is the candidate who knows what the five forces are for.
Yes.
Like they know it's kind of related to industry attractiveness, mm-hmm. but they don't know it's the long-term drivers of industry profitability, of average industry profitability.
Yeah.
And much, much, much more scarce is the candidate who knows exactly how to use the framework, how to run a Porter's Five Forces analysis. I have never met a candidate who've read Porter's book.
Mm-hmm.
And this might sound a little pretentious from my side. I haven't read his whole book. I've read like half of his book. It's a really good book.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is so complex and so nuanced, and you can only know that it's that nuanced if you read the book. Even an MBA class won't help you with that. It's so nuanced that if you really don't understand it in depth, you can't say you're gonna do a five forces analysis. And you know what? I've never seen anyone doing that at my time at McKinsey.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not really that useful. Like, you can use parts of it. You can talk about barriers to entry. But then it comes my other rant about this. Like, people talk about barriers to entry, and then you ask them, what are the barriers to entry in this industry? Like, tell me, like, five of them. Mm-hmm. Or tell me the ones that come to your mind. And they then keep saying more and more buzzwords. Like, oh, economies of scale is a barrier to entry. And also another barrier to entry is our branding. And like, if you ask them about economies of scale, like either they unroll more and more buzzwords or they don't know what they're talking about. Also, half of the barriers to entry they said don't fit the right definition of barriers to entry. And here I think comes that problem of the medical student, not the one who's overusing words to try to fit in, but the one who hadn't studied medicine well or enough.
Yeah.
And then they're saying, well, this is a autoimmune disease. And the other doctors are like, well, this is not really an autoimmune disease, you know. I don't know how often that happens with medical doctors. I hope not very often. As I hope that candidates stop misusing these Porter words that have very specific definitions to try to fit in, are not even really that useful in a case interview. And they're using them wrong. Sorry, I get really mad at this.
Yeah, what you just reminded me of is that the thing with Porter's Five Forces is it's a framework that tries to be exhaustive at listing conceptually all the long-term industry average profitability drivers. And for each specific industry, just a few are going to be relevant. It's like you have a freaking huge toolbox. And for every problem you find, you say, I'm going to use a screwdriver, right? You're going to use a screwdriver and a hammer and a ruler. I don't know. That's what you're going to use. If you say you're going to use the toolbox, you clearly don't know how to solve that problem. And don't get us wrong, right? Porter's Five Forces is one of the most business sense packed readings I've ever done. Like, I've read part of the book as well. I've read a few articles.
Just to clarify, his book is called Competitive Advantage, at least his main book.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to read that, that's the name of the book. It's a good one. I recommend to people. If you don't have months to prepare, it's probably not the most time effective thing to read. And please don't try to use it directly in your cases. Go ahead, Julio. Sorry.
Yeah. If you don't have all that much time, you can just read the one chapter where Porter explains what are the five forces, what are the drivers within each, and what do they mean? That is a ton of business sense packed stuff. If you look at each one of them, he has several examples. And you're going to understand things like, why is it exactly that if a supplier has the possibility of entering my market, my profitability is going to drop? And once you have that in your mind, that's going to be a part of your business sense library that you're going to use.
Now, the important thing is he explains the mechanics of how this happens.
Mm-hmm.
What I see most people doing when they use these buzzwords, either the five forces umbrella buzzword or like risk of new entrants, is they say, well, there is a risk of new entrants, thus the profitability is lower. And I think there are two problems with this. The first is that 90% of the times they do that, it's not even relevant to the case, because you're talking about something so abstract. And cases are such practical situations that it doesn't really matter. I have an analogy to that that I want to go into in a few moments. But the second problem with that is that if the introvert challenges you, oh, interesting, how does the threat of new entrants reduce the profitability for this specific company? Like, people can't explain the mechanics of how this happens. And what's brilliant about Porter is that he explains the mechanics for everything. He explains the effect that that happens. He almost proves how inevitable it is that average industry profitability is going to go down when there is a threat of new entrants. Now, here's the other thing I was going to talk about, the analogy, if I may, is that, let's say you're a medical doctor, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you take this class on public health. So you're talking about the health of millions of people in a country or thousands of people in a city or town. You learn a bunch of stuff, but not a lot of it is actually applicable to one individual patient's health that comes to your office or to the hospital. And Porter's Five Forces is kind of like that. It talks about average industry profitability. So it tries to explain why the pharma industry is so profitable and why the airline industry is so unprofitable. It doesn't try to explain why Pfizer is profitable and why Delta is unprofitable. And it doesn't try to explain how come Southwest Airlines is profitable. So obviously it gives you hints. And some of the concepts apply both to the individual example, the company, and the whole industry, because industries are composed of individual parts. But it's like back to my medical public health analogy. If you've got a patient that comes to your office and has diarrhea, you don't usually ask about what is the sanitation infrastructure in their house. Unless you have very good reason to believe that that's the problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
But sanitation is a huge topic in public health. So it's just a minor example to say that sometimes what matters to the macro doesn't really matters to the micro, specifically to the individual patient. And all of this is to say that usually you don't have to use Porter's Five Forces to solve problems that individual companies have, which is 99% of cases.
And in 100% of cases, you don't have to actually say Porter's Five Forces.
Yeah.
You're never going to have to say this.
And if you're going to use economies of scale, barriers to entry, threats of new entrants or substitutes, be damn sure what those things mean and how they impact a market.
Yeah.
And you can do that just by reading one chapter of Porter, the one Julio recommends. I don't trust my memory, but I think it's chapter number 3.
I think so.
Yeah, it's somewhere around that.
Mm-hmm.
Right, should we move on to the next one?
Yeah. What is buzzword number 5?
Buzzword number 5 you should avoid to get an offer in a case interview is SWOT analysis. Strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. I think it's the first framework I learned when I studied business, Julio. I remember it was like in the first few days of class. What's your perspective on this one? This one isn't that common among candidates, at least in my personal experience.
It's not that common among candidates, but it's on the same category as border side forces. It is using an authority argument rather than trying to think for first principles. You're going to say, well, how am I going to define the strategy of this company? Oh, I'm going to identify the threats and the weaknesses and the strengths and the opportunities. You don't need to say that. You can just identify them and label them as strengths, opportunities, threats, whatever.
Yeah, I think there's a couple. It's very similar to Porter's Five Forces, I agree. I think there's a couple more problems with this one. Like, the main problem with Porter's Five Forces is twofold. One is that people don't use them when they should use them. They use them out of context because it sounds smart.
Mm-hmm.
And the second is that people don't know everything about the thing. And it's very complicated to learn. So I don't think the problem is that people haven't learned enough about Porter's Five Forces, but that they try to use them when they haven't learned enough. Now, the problem with the SWOT analysis thing is a different one. I agree with you that it's an argument of authority, like, but it's of a different kind. How can doing a SWOT analysis be wrong? It's very hard to argue with that. So, but it's the same problem with customer research and marketing. Like, how can it be right?
Yeah.
It's so generic. So it's different than Porter. Like, Porter, people use them when they shouldn't.
Yeah.
SWOT, I don't think they ever should use SWOT. And If you want to get nerdy with me, here's why I think the SWOT analysis is so generic. When you create a structure, and the SWOT analysis is a structure, you want it to be messy, right? Now, if you've watched our videos or read our articles, there are 5 ways to be messy. And some of them are better than the others in specific contexts, but I basically break down the 5 ways to be messy into 3 core techniques, which tend to be stronger, more insightful than the other 2, which are auxiliary techniques. So the 3 core techniques are algebra structures, so math equations, process structures, so breaking down a process into parts, and conceptual frameworks, which are when you group concepts into categories, buckets, as people say. And then there are 2 auxiliary ways of building a structure in a messy way, which is segmentation, slicing the pie to different groups, and opposite words.
Mm-hmm.
And the weakest way to structure a problem is using opposite words. It's also the most versatile and easy one to use because you can always say, oh, external and internal, supply and demand, positive or negative.
Mm-hmm.
It's very easy to use. And I think it's great to use them as complements. But if they're the basis of your structure, like if they're the first layer of your structure in a very important problem, like it's hard to add insight by breaking the world into 2 things that are opposite, right?
Yeah.
Everyone can do it. Like my young cousin, like my 12-year-old cousin can do it. I don't have a 12-year-old cousin, by the way. I just made her up. But she's super funny in my imagination. So what's the problem with the SWOT analysis? The SWOT analysis is a matrix of 2 opposite words, 2 sets of opposite words.
By the way, 2 sets of opposite words that would fit any possible case.
Right. And any possible life scenario.
It doesn't even need to be business.
It doesn't. It doesn't even have to be the toothbrush test. It could be the relationship test. It could be like personal relationships. Or, you know, so for people listening to this, so it's clear in their minds, the 2 sets of opposite words are external and internal, and then positive and negative. Mm-hmm. So positive external is opportunities. Positive internal is strengths. Negative external is threats. and negative internal is weaknesses. So it's a useful thing to have in the back of your head to maybe double check some structure that you create. But let's put it this way, you're not getting paid hundreds or thousands of dollars per hour to do this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the way I say it now, it seems like, oh, so we should make the words fancy so we can charge more. So that's the whole consulting business model. That's what a cynic or a YouTube hater that comments in some of our videos would say. And the answer is no, that's not the point. The point is that one of your jobs as a consultant is getting to the core issues, the insight, the meat, like the really crunchy, juicy synthesis of what the problem is. And these perfectly logical yet generic ways of breaking down the world will never get you there. You've got to get to actual meaning, like something that's actually meaningful for that client in that situation, in that industry, that makes your client see their business in a way that makes perfect sense, that changes their actions and revisits the way they see their own strategy and their own business and that they've never seen before. And of course, like the bar for a case interview is much lower because you have 30 minutes and you're not a partner and you don't have a team full of consultants to help you out and experts and stuff like that. But you gotta show your interviewer that you at least have the potential to do this.
Mm-hmm.
If you're given months to work on a project and then years to, you know, develop yourself as a senior consultant and eventually a partner. And like, you don't even get to the lowest bar possible by using a SWOT analysis because, as I said in the beginning, like, I've learned that in my undergrad business degree in the third day of class.
Yeah.
And unlike Porter's Five Forces, there's not much depth you can go after you learn the four quadrants. Mm-hmm. Like, that's it.
Yeah.
I went on another rant here. I get really ranty with these themes.
Yeah, they're touchy-feely themes for us, the buzzwords, because we spent a lot of time helping candidates unlearn the buzzwords. And it was tough.
Yeah.
It was tough on us. It was tough on them. Like, it involved actually showing them that they thought they were doing something right. They were actually doing something wrong. They thought they were sounding smart, but they were actually sounding dumb. And they learned that they needed to start thinking in a way that was hard rather than thinking in a way that was easy. So it was tough. So we get emotional with it.
Yeah. You know what sounds smart, Julio?
Hmm.
Speaking in precise, simple terms that everyone, even your mom, could understand. And being right,
mm-hmm.
using that kind of simple, precise language. That's smart. That's what I would see senior partners at McKinsey do. And it's interesting because I would very rarely see a senior partner that used the buzzword at all.
Yeah.
Unless it was like really precise jargon from the industry that they were involved for the past mm-hmm. 10 years. Then they would.
Yeah, and then it wouldn't be buzzword. It would have a very specific meaning attached to it.
Like a medical doctor talking about a specific disease.
Yeah.
It has a name. Not everyone understands mm-hmm. it, but other doctors do. And that's why there's value into it. All right, mm-hmm. Julio. May I add a sixth buzzword to this episode? And this one's like a minute long.
All right.
Because I picked on the marketing people who try to solve everything with marketing, advertising, and customer research.
Mm-hmm.
Now I want to pick on the engineers. Quality. That's the buzzword. Oh, so we're losing customers. Therefore, one thing we can do is to increase the product's quality. And if it's not self-evident, the problem is the same. Like, quality doesn't mean anything. Like,
yeah.
To me, this microphone is high quality because it fits my needs.
Mm-hmm.
If you give it to, I don't know, Bon Jovi or Michael Jackson or even like Joe Rogan, like, they wouldn't think this microphone is high quality. If you give it to, I don't know, some journalist on the streets, this microphone's probably too big for them. And it's probably too expensive for people with lower needs as well. So there's no such thing as quality. Like, actually, there is. Quality is, does it meet spec? But usually, the problem is either quality control, which is our products are not meeting spec, or we need to change some features and benefits of this product so they better fit our ideal customers' needs. So just to give the marketing people some slack and pick on the engineers a little bit, the problem is not saying marketing or research, it's saying broad words that have no specific meaning and that are really hard to argue against. Like, how can you say that the product should be lower quality?
Yeah.
And my answer to that, well, maybe it should because it's too expensive right now.
Yeah.
And our customers don't care at all about how the finish is. They just want a product they can use.
Yeah. If you look at the pattern between all of these, all of them would not pass the toothbrush test. They would work in a toothbrush case. They would work in an airline case. Many of them would even work in a relationships case.
Yeah. Which calls out for an episode on the toothbrush test.
It does.
Coming out.
It does. Look out for it. Now, Bruno, I feel like we dove in depth in what to do with the urges that come to say buzzwords in each specific buzzword. Do you have any final words to our listeners on what to do, how to take action on this?
Okay, one practical tip I can give is after you finish every case, you should do a case debrief. If you feel like you're using buzzwords, words that maybe are too generic or that you don't really know the meaning, maybe you think you know, but you're not certain about it, review your notes after the case and look for words that if you were challenged by the interviewer on very specific things, for example, how should we use this tool? Why is this the right tool and not others? If you see anything that doesn't pass the toothbrush test, and you can always watch the YouTube video to understand this better, then first, get smart about that and to try to not use that buzzword anymore. Or if you're going to use it, for example, customer research, it's hard to find a simpler, non-jargony words to substitute that. If you're going to use it, always say the how, the whom you're going to do customer research with. Just like say how you're going to use that.
Mm-hmm.
Would you give a different tip or another tip?
I do have another tip that I think would be useful for them. And that is try to identify the vague words, the words that would fit any case that your mock interview partners use. And then
that's a good one.
Challenge them on it. Ask them what they mean by it, what exactly they would do, and why. You are going to get in the interviewer's shoes, and you're going to be able to foresee those questions coming. And honestly, you're also going to be a better interviewer for them, because hardly any mock interview partners ask follow-up questions, and every single real MBB interviewer asks follow-up questions. Once you do that, you're going to get in the shoes of the interviewers and you're going to understand why they're asking and you're going to be able to see that in yourself when you're being interviewed.
Yeah, it's a good one. And one way to ask follow-up questions in general is to notice, could they be full of shit in this one? pardon my French. But then ask them, what do you mean by this? Like, how'd you go about it? And
why are you saying this? Why are you going to do this?
Yeah, what are other options related to this? So you can deviate from the case script a little bit and go into that. And you can, even if you can't find mock interview partners that do that to you, you can do that to you afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
Like you can create your own drills for follow-up questions using questions that your mock interviewer should have asked you before.
Yeah, and if you have case partners that you do case frequently with, you could just send them this podcast episode and they'll listen to it. And you all can start asking those types of questions and you're all going to improve together.
Yeah.
All right. Bruno, is this it for today?
Yeah, I guess that's it for today, Julio. Just a final message. People, please stop using these 5 buzzwords in your cases or use them correctly, at least.
Yes. Be precise. Explain why you're using them. How you're going to do it, give examples. That those are all buzzwords that are going to help you use buzzwords better. Thank you for listening to the Case Interview Podcast.
If you want to get more insights into how to prepare like the best candidates and increase your chances of getting your dream offer, you can listen to our entire back catalog, starting from episode 1. In fact, some of our best episodes are the ones we recorded earlier on. And if you want to go deeper and learn our best case-solving techniques, we welcome you to join our free course called Case Interview Fundamentals. And you can get instant access to it at craftingcases.com/course. Now, I hope to see you in the next episode, or in one of the previous ones.